We now look at four documents from the pen of Pope John Paul II, which are of relevance to biomedical ethics. The first two are significant documents in the sense that the first is an apostolic letter, Salvifici Doloris, written in 1984 on the Christian meaning of human suffering, and the other is an encyclical letter, Evangelium Vitae, written in 1995. Now, these categories, apostolic letter and encyclical letter, mean, among other things, that this document was very carefully looked at, very carefully footnoted, it was specifically addressed to the whole world, and it was not specifically occasioned by a particular event or need. But we will look at two other documents that are simply addresses of the Pope. Now, all of these belong to the Magisterium, that is, all of these are papal statements, but these addresses have a much more narrow focus. The address from March of 2004, and the trouble with these addresses is they don't have official titles. They are addresses to the participants of a particular conference, but they do deal with a particular subject, and so I've titled them with the subject. The one from March of 2004 is on life-sustaining treatment and the vegetative state, and from November of 2004, just a few months later, a document which deals with the question of palliative care, which, as we'll see, is a question that the Pope treated in his other texts as well. We will be looking at those because they are significant in that they address a particular issue, but we cannot expect as much of them as one would expect of a full-blown encyclical or apostolic letter. Now, in fact, the first document on the meaning of human suffering, Salvifici Doloris, from 1984, it does not deal with bioethical issues very much, but I wanted to include it for our consideration because in it the Pope does a splendid job of meditating on one of the most difficult passages from the letter to the Colossians, in which we have this mysterious statement where Paul is saying, I rejoice in my sufferings for your sake and in my flesh. I complete what is lacking in Christ's afflictions for the sake of his body, that is, the church. This has been a source of puzzlement and a complex exegesis since the very early church. Are Christ's sufferings complete and sufficient for our salvation? And if so, how can Paul possibly say that he is completing what is lacking in Christ's affliction? How could anything be lacking in the sufferings of the second person of the Trinity for us human beings? Well, what Paul seems to be reflecting on, and what certainly the Pope is particularly focusing on, is the fact that for Christians, suffering has meaning. Suffering is something that can be consecrated, that can be offered to God, and in so doing, there is a mysterious participation in the sufferings of Christ. There is a drawing into closer union with God, and that is difficult to explain or to describe without sounding dangerously masochistic or sadistic, sounding as if one wants to suffer in order to be more holy, or that one thinks other people should suffer so that they could be more holy, or in a kind of a misguided sense that there is an additional kind of suffering that God requires of the universe in order for all human beings to be saved. So this doctrine can be, and certainly has been, throughout Christian history, drastically misused, but in this document, and I'd invite you to read these few paragraphs that I've included, and meditate on them. The Pope really does a lovely job of trying to describe, in a very balanced and effective way, these principles that human suffering does have value and does have meaning. One's not trying to induce it, but it is a mysterious reaching out into relationship with Christ, and that in a way that is very difficult to articulate, it is somehow of benefit to the rest of the world. It in a way is a means by which God is touching the lives of others as well. And so If you look into the second paragraph, the Apostle Paul bears tribulations in union with Christ. He receives the strength that's already been mentioned and completes by his suffering, and then he quotes what is lacking in Christ's affliction. This highlights the truth concerning the creative character of suffering, meaning that suffering is not merely about an end, about extinction, it's also about creation. It can, if one offers it to God, acquire a meaning and a value. Now, this is important for those who are involved in the care, especially the health care of others. One can never try to tell another person what the meaning of their suffering is. That is for them to discover in the mystery of their union with Christ, their deepening relationship with the Lord. One can ask them if they have discovered this and ask them to share it, but it is a very dangerous and, in fact, a kind of a violent and destructive thing to do, to tell someone else, well, you have to suffer because Christ expects it. Or to use the rather unhelpful phrase that was sometimes very popular in the Catholic past, just offer it up. No, there is a deeper mystery to this that involves tremendous empathy and compassion on the part of the person who is helping the suffering individual. And the most one can do is to give them hope and to try to help them find meaning, that there is value, but not to expect them to articulate that value any sooner or to any greater degree than they're able to at any given moment in time. And certainly in the process of suffering and dying, sometimes the meaning one finds can seem at the time to be very dark and negative indeed, but working with and being with another person can facilitate this moving towards what the Pope is here trying to articulate. The text that I've highlighted in yellow, no one can add anything to Christ's suffering, but at the same time, in the mystery of the Church as his body, Christ has, in a sense, opened his own redemptive suffering to all human suffering. That is, Christ reaches out to, touches, and consecrates, rather in the way that the bread and the wine of the Eucharist are consecrated and transformed. Not exactly the same way, of course, but God is present in it, he is redeeming it, he gives it value, precisely because Christ himself suffered. In any part of the world, at any time in history, to that extent, he in his own way completes the suffering through which Christ accomplished the redemption of the world. So there is a drawing into the mystery of what Christ did that can take place for those who are suffering and who choose to allow their suffering to be that for them. And again, he says, no, this is not a question of saying that Christ's redemption is in any sense incomplete, but that the redemption accomplished through satisfactory love remains always open to all love expressed in human sufferings. There's always something that can be added to, which a new and unique meaning can be found in, that each person contributes insofar as they offer their experience of limitation and suffering to God. So, again, this is not strictly speaking bioethical, but it certainly is at the very basis of anyone who is involved in trying to minister to those who are suffering with issues connected with receiving of health care. The next document, Evangelium Vitae, the Gospel of Life, literally translated from 1995. This document is a very clear, earlier than the documents from the CDF that we've already looked at, attempt to supply John Paul II's own meditative, profoundly spiritual, and contemplative underpinnings, and in some cases his drawing out of deeper meanings and values to issues which had arisen and would be dealt with more specifically, theologically, and juridically in some of the documents that we've seen. So here, in Evangelium Vitae, this Gospel of Life, it's rather beautiful than in number 42, and I should mention that in many of his encyclicals and official letters, a great deal of the text will be spent in a very beautiful but rather dense form of exegesis, of interpreting the scriptures in a tradition that's often called Lectio Divina, a kind of a contemplative mulling over and praying with the text, so that one very often has to look very carefully and very specifically to find the nuggets that represent the conclusion, which is what I've attempted to do here. And number 42, defending and promoting life, showing reverence and love for it, a task that God entrusts to everyone. Then he uses the image of Genesis. We are to be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth and subdue it. He says we have a specific responsibility towards the environment in which we live. Therefore, issues of bioethics, issues of a gospel of life, necessarily involve not only our own life as individuals or even our life as a race, but the life of the whole planet, the life of the whole world. We have a specific responsibility in our environment. And he reminds us that the dominion granted to human beings by the Creator is not an absolute power. So he roots his meditation on, his reflection on questions of bioethical concern in this awareness that we are in this close interrelationship with all other forms of life that God has created here in this world of which we are to be the stewards. Then in number 44, he highlights this text, "You formed my inmost being," and he mentions the question of the dignity of the unborn child. And here what we're going to see is that he adds theological, in some cases even meditative and poetic interpretations of the traditions he's received and which he will then pass on. Human life is itself most vulnerable when it enters the world and when it leaves the realm of time. So showing care and respect above all at the beginning and the end of life is part of our task as human beings. He mentions in regard to the beginning of life in number 58, no one could be more absolutely innocent than a newborn child or a human embryo. No one absolutely more innocent could be imagined. In no way could this human being ever be considered an aggressor, much less an unjust aggressor. And this is his answer to a theological argument that perhaps sometimes abortion might be permissible if one regarded the child as an unjust aggressor. He or she is weak, defenseless, even to the point of lacking that minimal defense consisting in the poignant power of a newborn baby's cries and tears. So he's utterly denying and providing a very beautiful meditative reflection on the reason for the denial of the concept that the unborn child could ever be regarded morally as an unjust aggressor. Then in number 59, still pondering the question of abortion, he very beautifully and pastorally extends the question to not just the question of a mother's choice to have an abortion, but to the broader question of why has she made this choice? For example, we are very quick often to blame the woman herself, but what about the father? He may have exerted pressure on the woman to have an abortion, encouraging directly such a decision by leaving her alone to face the problems of pregnancy, a tragic but very frequent occurrence in our world. Nor, he says, can one overlook the pressures that sometimes come from the wider family circle and from friends. There, too, is responsibility for abortion, not just the woman, but her husband, her family, maybe even her friends. He says, sometimes she's subjected to such strong pressures, she feels psychologically forced to have the abortion. And then he extends it still further. Not only those individuals, but legislators who've promoted and approved abortion laws, administrators of health care centers where these are performed, indeed, all of those who have encouraged the spread of an attitude of sexual permissiveness and a lack of esteem for motherhood. So he's very beautifully and pastorally trying to invite people to not focus exclusively on the question of the crime committed by the mother, but to look also at the important social and psychological issues that accompany this great great tragedy. Then in regard to euthanasia, here he quotes previously existing traditions, particularly the document on euthanasia that we've seen, Jura et Bona. Euthanasia is to be distinguished from the decision to forego aggressive medical treatments. In other words, treatments that no longer correspond to the patient's real situation. And this is not the same thing, he says in the next highlighted text of number 65. This is not the same thing as euthanasia or suicide. Foregoing extraordinary or disproportionate means is not the equivalent of suicide or euthanasia. And then he specifically mentions palliative care. In modern medicine, increased attention is given to methods of palliative care which seek to make suffering more bearable in the final stages of illness and to ensure that the patient is supported and accompanied in his or her ordeal. One needs to add, palliative care is not only for the end of life, it means specifically treating symptoms rather than attempting to cure. But here the Pope is speaking of it as a good, and indeed in the Catechism, as we'll see and elsewhere, it's referred to as a necessary, indeed essential form of love, a special form of compassion. And he highlights in number 66 that when we are reflecting on euthanasia, we need to remember that compassion should lead to sharing another's pain, not destroying the person who is in pain. Compassion means sharing another's pain. It does not kill the person whose suffering we cannot bear. And this is his point, that sometimes euthanasia is motivated not by a real empathetic sense of what the other is experiencing, but because we experience the suffering one as painful ourselves. So euthanasia can be a way of getting rid of that embarrassment or that confrontation with death which we can't bear. In number 67, he points out again that the way of love and true mercy recognizes that those who are confronted with suffering and death may seem to be despairing or asking for death, but this is a request for companionship, sympathy, and support in the time of trial. It's a request for all of us to encourage others to keep on hoping when all human hopes fail. A reminder that a request for euthanasia is so very often simply a cry for help and an expression of profound loneliness and a sense of abandonment and of pain. Then we've already looked at the beginning of the course at this problem of the legislator's unenviable dilemma. He notes in number 73 that in a world where sometimes all we can do is choose the least harmful option, in some cases the only way to move forward in promoting legislation that decreases the effect of abortion would be to vote for something that appears to be supporting abortion but is actually the only way that one can participate in a process that is limiting or cutting this back. And he says in particular, in a case like he's just mentioned, when it's not possible to overturn or completely abrogate a pro-abortion law, an elected official whose absolute personal opposition to procured abortion was well known. So this only applies in the case of someone who has made it clear that they are absolutely opposed to abortion. They could licitly support a proposal aimed at limiting the harm done by such a law and lessening its negative consequence at the level of general opinion and public morality. That is, voting for a law to decrease the harm, but a law which might still include the possibility of obtaining an abortion. This is something that is not well understood by our Catholic faithful. But again, this has nothing to do with a legislator who declares that they think abortion is neutral or that, although personally opposed, they would regard it as a matter for an individual to choose. That's not the same thing that the Pope is referring to here. And in number 86, the Pope speaks specifically of organ donation. He regards it as a particularly praiseworthy example of a heroic action, of a radiant manifestation of the highest degree of love. So he's very much in favor of organ donation and specifically encourages it, as does the Catechism, as we shall see. Then in number 88, he mentions again the importance of families receiving help from social welfare agencies and, if necessary, from palliative care organizations. So this is the second time that he's mentioned the importance of palliative care, of treating symptoms when diseases can't actually be cured. And he does mention, finally, in number 91, that politicians do have the right to address the question of population growth, but such interventions must always take into account and respect primary and inalienable responsibility of married couples and families, cannot employ methods that fail to respect the person and fundamental human rights. So he acknowledges that indeed population growth is an issue of public policy that can be addressed, but the methods of addressing it must not undermine or set aside human rights. And we now turn to two documents that were both published, that were both promulgated during the last year of the Pope's life. And these are not encyclical letters, strictly speaking. They are his addresses intended to summarize and conclude his own reflections based on a meeting that took place in Rome. The first one having to do with the complex question of the persistent vegetative state, and the second one having to do with palliative care. We will look at these documents in more detail when we consider the questions of euthanasia in more detail, but I just want us to be aware of the existence in particular of the second document on palliative care, because the non-Catholic, that is the secular press, strongly emphasized and highlighted the document on life-sustaining treatment and the vegetative state, in which the Pope rightly says people in the vegetative state, the persistent vegetative state, are not dying. They are in a stable condition in which, if they receive nutrition and hydration, they can live for a very long time. They are not dying. And indeed, this is a syndrome. That is to say, it's not a specific disease. It's a diagnostic category with a wide variety of forms of expression. And there are all kinds of interesting and, in some cases, very unsettling bits of research that are being done into patients who are in the persistent vegetative state, but who turn out to have more mentation, more capacity to respond to external stimuli and even language than was previously thought possible. So in some ways, the Pope's document was prophetic, and what he basically says is these people are not dying, therefore they should be given food and water. They should be given nutrition and hydration. And so in the context of this particular issue, he states the principles that I've highlighted, and I should mention the reason the non-Catholic press emphasized this was because they thought it was really stupid. Yet again, these awful Catholics are trying to impose an irresponsible morality on the rest of the world. Now everybody in a Catholic institution will have to have a feeding tube. That was the conclusion of the lay press, and unfortunately, that has been the false interpretation that's been given to this document, even by some individuals involved in Catholic healthcare, which is why the other document on palliative care is so important. But let's just look at the text itself very briefly, and as I said, we'll come back to this. The Pope says, I should like to underline how administration of water and food, even when provided by artificial means, by a nasogastric or a gastrostomy tube, a tube that goes through the nose or goes directly into the stomach through an artificial hole in the abdomen, these always represent a natural means of preserving life, not a medical act. So they are natural, ordinary care that is to be provided to people who are in this very, very limiting and debilitating state, but these people are not dying. Therefore, its use should be considered, and notice that I've highlighted and read in principle. Now, the original of this document was Italian, not Latin, in linea de principio, in principle, that is to say, generally speaking, in most cases, ordinary and proportionate, and therefore morally obligatory. That is not the same thing as saying absolutely always in all circumstances. As we've seen, when any modality, even if it's ordinary, even if it's a natural means of preserving life, when it becomes burdensome to the individual, they are not obliged to make use of it, especially at the end of life. And the Pope is certainly not in any sense contradicting that. He's simply trying to say that in this diagnostic category, where you have profoundly disabled people who cannot speak for themselves, they have what appear to be wake-sleep cycles, but by definition they're incapable of either responding to or communicating using language, these individuals should be fed and offered hydration. They're not dying. Again, the document was drastically misinterpreted, and the claim was made, well, this means all Catholics have to have feeding tubes when they no longer are capable of eating and drinking. Well, it's very likely that this second document, a drop-down note at number 2.4 on palliative care, again, that's not the title, these documents don't have titles, but that's what it's about, it's likely that this response was precisely because of the misinterpretation of that document, and it clarifies things beautifully. However, it was not highlighted by the press. This was ignored by the lay press because it's a very responsible, reasonable document that disproves the assertion that Catholics are trying to thrust feeding tubes into everybody who's in the process of dying. And as a consequence, again, it was ignored. But now you know that it exists, and you, in your own ministry and work, will be able to point it to people who have misinterpreted or misapplied the other document, which is specifically focused on the question of the persistent vegetative state. And again, we'll be going over these issues in more detail a little bit later. But let's just look finally at number 2.4 here, one is to recognize the dignity of everyone, even when illness is a burden. A reminder that euthanasia is an elimination of the person. True compassion draws the line when it is clear that further treatment will not serve the purpose of enabling the person to recovery. So compassion recognizes that to refuse aggressive treatment is not a rejection of the patient nor of their life. The real question is medical intervention beneficial? And I've highlighted in red, consequently, the decision to forego aggressive treatment is an expression of the respect that is due to the patient at every moment. And in particular, individuals have the right to make use of palliative care at the end of life. Especially, people are not obliged to make use of modalities of treatments that they experience or that can be reasonably presumed to be experienced as burdensome to them. So here is a validation of the appropriateness of palliative care, and it's important to hold this together with the assertion that one finds in the document concerned with the persistent vegetative state.